Business is simple. It's just not easy. We focus on three things to help you run and grow your business more easily: talent, sales, and how to scale. This is the Talent, Sales, and Scale Show. Hey everyone, Brian Whittington with this episode of the Talent, Sales, and Scale Show. I've been practicing for days and days now on how to get this name right, and let's try it out. So I am with the ever effervescent, energetic Amy Rahavacek.
Oh, Brian, that was great. That was great.
Anyway, check her out. She is the podcast host of Revenue Real Hotline and also showrunner. So she might talk a little bit about this, but it's pretty cool that if you have an internal podcast that you're looking to do, she'll train you how to do this. So pretty cool there. She's also a member of Rev Genius, so giving back all the time. She's a contributor to Sales Hacker, which was really cool because I didn't realize this, but that contribution to an article that she wrote on Sales Hacker allowed her a partnership with Andy Paul, one of my favorite. Look at a couple of episodes back whenever he was on talking about his book. So that is pretty cool stuff. And today, Amy joins us to talk about all things sales enablement. So with all of these changes, how in the world can we keep up with them and put sales enablement to actual use instead of a drag around your neck like so much of it? So all of that said, welcome to the show, Amy. And how do they pronounce your name for real?
Well, thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here and I appreciate the opportunity. And thank you, listeners, for checking us out. Oh my gosh, I forgot the question. What's the question?
How do you pronounce your last name?
Rahavacek. Rahavacek.
Rahavacek. So you'd think you'd be able to get that pretty easily. Rahavacek.
So, oh yeah. Well, can I buy a vowel, please? And yeah. Listeners, like I don't care, right? I made my peace with this in like the second grade, or I would never get anything done.
it's a good Irish name that you have there. So very nice.
Yeah.
Well, so I guess the first question, so we can dive right into this, Amy. I mean, you have a ton of background history in a number of different areas. Mm-hmm. But what makes you such an expert? Why should we listen to you about all things sales enablement and how to keep up with the changes and actually implement them effectively?
Well, it's funny. Whenever I'm speaking with sales enablement professionals, or really sales leaders or sellers, one of the first things that you got to do, given the let's call it new-ish nature of the role, is to define what the role is, right? What does sales enablement mean to you? And then listen, and then I'll give my definition, which tends to be a little bit different, but I think often we see organizations that just want to put like a sexy rebrand on the same old sales training. And that's just not what it is. But as far as like why listen to me, for starters, I'm a revenue human for life. I was raised by a sales VP. There was a short stint in politics that was going to be, I was going to be a lobbyist actually, Brian, which is the least trusted profession on the planet, only topped by sales. But anyway, I don't know what that says about my character, but then I sold for a decade, and finished really strong at Thomson Reuters, enterprise selling, top performer. I think that last year I hit my quota in February. And I won a company-wide award. Yeah, for the Spotcha Award. But then I pivoted to sales enablement and built out two departments. And of course, my work with Andy Paul and the Sell Without Selling Out book launch and now partnerships, I get to work with sellers and sales leaders of the most exquisite caliber every single day. And so why listen to me? I mean, I've made a ton of mistakes. And so I think that's always a good place to be, is you don't necessarily have to make your own mistakes as long as you learn from those of others. But also I'm selling every day. To sell is human. And so I can feel anybody that's kind of going through these learning curves. And as you know, I'm on a mission to make the process of developing sales mastery just way more fun. I just don't think it has to be drudgery.
And you have a cool New Jersey accent.
I do have a cool New Jersey accent. I'm also currently sitting on the Jersey Shore. I could literally hear the waves from my chair right now.
Well, I'm always envious of your pictures that you put up on LinkedIn with the ocean picture. So cool. Well, let's talk about defining that role, because too many people, they don't do that. They don't define what success is. So whenever you give the definition of here's what sales enablement is, why don't we start there? Because I mean, so many people just throw out everything. Oh, it's an infographic. Oh, it's a this, it's a that. It's a technology only. So why don't we start there with what's your definition of sales enablement?
Yeah, I love it. I think that it's almost, for me, it's more a guiding ethos, right? I believe that the role of sales enablement is to represent the voice of the field and voice of the customer, and to empower these human beings, our corporate athletes, while they undertake one of the most stressful and demanding jobs in the organization, hard stop. And with the knowledge that when sellers win, everyone wins. And so I think another piece that's important, or that I like to highlight, is what falls under the scope of sales enablement and what does not. What does not, I think a lot of the operations, right? So like the tech stack, I mean, don't get me wrong, I've done my fair share of trainings for product launches, and also, like, you know, driving adoption for a new pipeline tracking tool. But I think that that's more RevOps. For me, I think it's the content that you're creating internally and externally, whether it's a training, an internal podcast, playbooks as a great example. It's also your processes, right? So I've got a green belt in process design. And so one of my favorite things to do is to look at what's the current state of what's happening right now, and to find those gaps and look for the opportunity areas. And then I, of course, a training and coaching, I think also falls squarely under sales enablement. And that, for the record, includes new manager coaching as well, which is a massive gap that I see on a lot of sales floors right now.
Wow. Okay. So I wasn't considering that at all. So there, you're not talking sales enablement as necessarily being the technology side at all. You're saying, hey, that should live over in the RevOps side. You're really talking about content creation, training. I want to hit what an internal podcast is, because I'd not heard of that terminology before. And you also talked about process, training, and coaching. I said training twice there, son of a gun. So let's hit the internal podcast. What exactly is that?
Okay. So when you think about the medium, right, we hear a lot of talk about people using video during their sales motions, right? Video, email, social, these are just channels. The podcast is a phenomenal channel to enable and empower the sales team. But to your point, it's very new, right? Most people, when they think podcast, they think of external podcast. But there are some pretty exquisite ways to actually create some internal podcasts and then push them to, you know, the streaming app. So where people are already listening to their podcast. So you don't have to deal with that behavior change aspect. Now, what is, or why does this channel, why does this medium, why is this an exceptional fit for sales enablement? I think the first one and the most important one is it meets sellers where they're at, right? They're on the move. And it also untethers learning from sitting at your fucking computer. I don't know if you're allowed to curse on this show, but And so when you think about it from the, like, be more inclusive or the neurodivergent, ADHD is one example, we have to be moving while we're learning. It's very difficult to consume and retain new information while you're sitting still. And so from that perspective, it's a win, but also the caliber of attention that you're able to get through the podcast, it just trumps anything else. Like, take video as one example. When you are watching a video on YouTube or in your sales enablement platform, be it HighSpot, Seismic, MindTickle, whatever, you probably, if you're like me, you've got a bunch of other tabs open and you're playing in Slack and you're checking emails as they come in. But when you're listening to a podcast, you tend to be, you know, more into a routine. So you're walking the dog. you're driving the kids to school, you're, you know, like doing dishes. I was just listening to your show, Brian, doing some dishes. And so the caliber of attention that you get is a lot richer. And so the knowledge that you're able to push, it's stickier. And I think it's half the cost of video production. So that's like a win right there. And you're able to democratize the voices on the team. So let's say you're doing a conversation series with top performers or a best practices series. You're giving your people the opportunity to learn best from the group inside the organization, where most sellers actually learn the most from, and that is from their peers. So with that, I'm going to pause.
No, I appreciate that. So this does not live in your LMS. You're suggesting that you do this through, I mean, just push it out to like a Spotify or something like that?
Precisely. Okay. That's a choice, right? That an organization can make, but I mean, it's like all things with change, right? Sales is always changing. Are you, a lot of the learning platforms, even like outside of sales enablement, like a Degreed, they weren't built to facilitate the podcast medium yet. Mm-hmm. You know, the feature set really hasn't caught up yet. And so there's, that's a thing, but I think it's important also for an organization to look at how their content is being consumed right now, right? What percentage of your organization is already going to your learning platform to consume information? How frequently is that happening?
Not a lot is the answer all the time.
Exactly. Exactly. And so in many ways, you can just bypass all of that at the beginning, but these are certainly conversations that we have during the planning phase of our projects and these internal podcast launches.
Well, so here's another question. There's a couple of different ways that people learn. And mm-hmm. it seems like you and I learn through audio. So I cannot read a book. It goes in one eye and out the other, right? So I had to listen to Andy Paul's book on an audio book. I can do video, but I tend not to watch the video. I put it on 2X. I put a podcast on 2X. That way I consume information much more quickly, right?
Right.
So would it very much depend on how they consume content and how they learn as to whether or not an internal podcast would be good?
Yeah, I mean, that's always a factor, but point of information, my learning style is actually reading long form. But as part of my ADHD, I'm hypersensitive. And we were joking around before the call about, you know, it being a superpower. Really, what that means is that I'm more in tune than most to the sensory aspects around learning. And there's actually a funny story here, which we could decide whether or not to share. However, when you're able to engage more than one sense in the learning process, right? This is why taking notes is such a killer move, right? Think in ink, because if you're listening and then you're writing, or if you're reading and you're highlighting, you're seeing or you're hearing, and you're also touching. And so there are certain things that you can do to drive that retention. But I think that there's also some shifts in like just learning trends that are a little bit different than the, like, let's say, old school learning styles. For example, micro learning is another big one. Micro learning in that you cut your content.
Why don't you define that a little bit? Because although that term's been around for maybe half decade or so, I don't think a lot of people even know about it. So can you hit what that means real quick?
Sure. So it's funny because I actually just changed the format on my show to accommodate this. I've been thinking a lot about this one, friends. All right. So micro learning. It's the concept of, it's like, I like to match micro learning with real-time learning as well. So let's say I just left the city and moved down to the Jersey Shore and I got a car, but I didn't get AAA yet. And I haven't owned a car in a long time, but I get a flat tire, right? Randomly, because I bought an old one and I don't have a car payment. But if I'm sitting on the side of the road with a flat tire, I'm going to, and without access to AAA, like, I think we all know, I would really just call a tow truck, but just go with me, friends. I would, if it was light out and there was a lot of space on the side of the road and I was in a like adventurous mood, I would decide to try to change the tire. So what would I do in that moment? I would do what everybody else on the planet would do. And I would grab my phone and open up YouTube and look for a tutorial a 5-minute tutorial on how to change the tire. And I would watch the video. Maybe I'd watch it again the second time. And then I would bring it outside and I would watch it while I'm physically changing the tire. Then the tire is changed. I have acquired the new skills and I am on my way. That is a micro learning opportunity. And so let's say in sales enablement, and we're doing a podcast series and it's on like how to calm your nerves right before a big meeting, or how to prepare for a meeting once you schedule it. And so a 10-minute content item, just going through the exact things that that person needs to learn or wants to learn in that moment. And so when you are able to collapse the time frame from learn something to try it, right? That's always a win on the retention front, but also it's far more, I think, like respectful of the other person's time too, because they don't have to dig through or work as hard to find the nuggets. And so that is what micro learning is.
Yeah. So micro learning is kind of like the Reader's Digest, the abridged version, the highlighted bullet points. So whenever you go through it, you can go back to it pretty darn quickly. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if it's like the abridged version. It's like taking one of those bullet points and doing a 5-minute deep dive on that one thing.
Which is what people are looking for anyway, because when they get to that step, they're like, how do I do that again? And then they're going through an hour's worth of training to try to find the 3-minute, 5-minute vignette, which that's what you're doing, is all of these vignettes right there at the fingertips.
Exactly. And what the challenge with not doing this is that it's the learned behavior. When you have to work so hard to find the thing that you're looking for and possibly not going to get it, even when you do work that hard, what are the chances you're going to go back to that source for a round two?
Not very good.
And which is why I think the usage in our learning platforms is a thing. And also, I think we could do a far better job of actually asking sellers what they need and where they're struggling before we just like go create a new like training program or case study or whatever.
Yeah, that's also helps. There's not a whole lot under the sun, right? It's just how do you do it a little bit differently, bring different perspectives, and everyone learns a little bit different. The personalities are a little bit different, and you can't do a one size fits all. That's one of the things that drive me crazy about the education system, is they completely leave out so many people that don't have that fixed mindset, academic mindset, more of those, that entrepreneurial spirit, people like you and I that cannot sit for more than like 10 minutes. That's why I'm at a standing desk all the time. I have not sat down yet because I can't. It's just impossible. And most organizations don't teach to that. They teach very systematically, academically, very in a boring way that doesn't help me. And I don't know if it helps you or not.
No, it doesn't. I don't like being bored and I don't like boring people while learning. And I think that learning is so damn fun. And I'm with you about the education system pigeonholing people, but we're doing it inside of our organizations too, with our sales enablement content. Like this is exactly why I think we can all do a better job of challenging the status quo and asking the tough questions of ourselves. Why am I doing it this way? How did it come to be? And who says that it can't be better? Hard stop. And you know, Brian, like I know that you do a lot of work on the community front. Like when you think about micro learning and the real-time access, this is one of the massive wins for community too, right? If you've got a place where you can crowdsource, hey, I'm working on this project charter for, you know, my new sales enablement department, and like I'm having trouble like aligning stakeholders or whatever. Has anybody worked through this, or you know, is anybody able to help me with this specific problem right now? And then either people respond on those threads with the answer, or they tag a friend, like phone a friend style, and so that person is able to source their answer, crowdsourced it, right? So it's quality answer. But then generally, what I've seen, somebody that's you know played with data inside communities, is the relationship that forms there with that one person. You now know who you can go to directly when you're in another moment where, you know, you need help with something and whatever. So you've found somebody that's able to help. And so the relationships that are formed and strengthened when we apply this micro learning real-time need with community is just next level.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I want to do, because I know on your podcast, you have more short format, right? So you have some long, but also some short formats too.
It's new. It's like I'm always be changing and iterating. So I'm not just like, do as I say, not as I do, friends. Like I'm actually trying to do this. But yes, I do mix it up.
So I haven't told James Bowden this. So James Bowden is the one that cuts and slices all the podcasts and post it, whatnot. What I'd ultimately like to do is have vignettes on this and drop the different smaller vignettes, because I think that's what people will go to. They're going to listen to that. I know whenever I'm looking on, flipping around on YouTube for stuff to learn or stuff to look at, I'm not watching the hour format, right? And here I am doing an hour long show. And it's how do you break it down? And that was kind of my idea the whole entire time, is break things down, have tools and infographics and all of these helpful pieces to go along with that long form to be able to break it down. So it's, what do they call it? Multi-purposing, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's funny that you said this too, because it almost comes back to your original point about people have different learning styles. You can create like right now we're recording on video. This is going to be a podcast. You mentioned video a couple of times. I don't know if you have a YouTube channel, but it's, you've got your transcripts that you can pull, and you can, again, repurpose just one piece of content in very simply or easily. We can create processes to do this, or, you know, outsource as needed. But it's not zero sum, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And so let's take the flip of this, right? So we're talking about short form, micro learning, making it fun. Let's talk about the boring stuff. Let's go to process. Mm-hmm. I love process that I don't have to follow. I'm really good at implementing process, because mm-hmm. that's where efficiency is. So how is it on the sales enablement team, as opposed to RevOps, opposed to VP of sales or CRO, to, you know, that, because process is oftentimes strategy or tied to strategy. Why sales enablement for process?
I mean, it depends on how you structure your sales enablement department and also your sales team, and even broader marketing, customer success, product, finance, legal, all obviously important roles. I think that one of the steps that people skip, right, when selling, when enabling, when leading, is to baseline, right? Assess the current state. And it's also, it's like the human brain, right? We see a problem and we have identified the solution in like all of 0.2 seconds, like that. And so, and then we become biased to that solution. And so part of learning to master process or process design or process optimization is to learn how to take those solutions that pop in your own brain and just like stick them in a solution jar, so that you have enough time to assess what's going on objectively. In Six Sigma or Lean, like we do these DMAIC projects, stands for define phase, measure phase, analyze phase, and then improve and control. And so that's the big one. There's so much insights to be gained from just observing what's going on, gathering the voice of the customer, gathering the voice of the field, and making no assumptions about what their actual problem is or how to solve for it. That's the first thing. The second thing is, when it comes to process, like I think there's a pretty serious skill gap in most conversations that I see or have been a part of historically. This is starting to change. But here's a perfect example. One of the things that a team can do, let's say we want to analyze deal velocity, just as one example, is to put more solid controls around the start of a phase and the end of a phase, and make sure that everyone on the team understands what exactly it is that needs to happen to move the opportunity from, let's say, demo to negotiation. And so once you can start measuring your process in pieces, then you can start to hone in on where the opportunities are to elevate the skills on the team. And as much as like, I want to say, oh, it's closing, oh, it's negotiation, or oh, it's contracting, like there's a pretty solid chance that it's discovery, right? And so like that's the other piece of it. But then also there's this thing, we call them dynamic systems. And these are systems that are flexible enough to be able to grow and to iterate. And I think that this is a really important concept when it comes to obviously enterprise selling, but the team is going to identify wins in how the buyers want to be worked with today. And so if the process is able to identify those bright spots, and to call attention to them and to scale them essentially up and out, you can expedite the pace with which everyone else on the team is, let's call it, upgrading their approach to how they're selling as well. And so these all fall under process. And I'm gonna pause there. There, I just dumped a lot of stuff on you, Brian.
So here's a curious thing, right? So we always want to challenge status quo, but process is there for a particular purpose. And so
let's talk about that. What is the purpose of a process? What is principle number one of process?
So my take is to drive repeatable efficiency, or drive efficiency in a repeatable process for all to be able to follow.
For all to be able to follow. Okay. So that we can have a predictable amount of revenue so we can report to our executives and our VCs and our shareholders. Principle one, though, process is that value flows at the pull of the client. And I happen to believe that the clients of the sales process are the actual clients, the buyers. And their process it's not linear, right? And it's certainly not reflected in most sales processes. And so that conflict is part of the reason why getting people to do something over and over again that like maybe doesn't feel good or feel right for the buyers, like it's like dragging a ball and chain. It's like Vant. Exactly. Oh, you've got a pain point. Okay. Pain identified onto the demo. Like it's just nonsense. But anyway, I think that there's an important role that process and like the steps play for new sellers, right? And here's how it's done. But I just really reject the idea that all buyers are the same or that all sellers are the same. And so figuring out a way to create some space for creativity, for autonomy, right? Think about how we're managing what SDRs do down to the day and task. And it's like somebody's got to be working pretty damn hard to not read any of the modern research about where productivity and performance actually comes from. And I'll give you a hint, like happiness, autonomy, creativity are all pretty solid parts of that. But I think one of the reasons that sales bosses, and I distinguish between sales bosses and sales leaders, want to get on the do these steps is because they're afraid. It's safer. It's air quotes easier to manage, but like pay no attention to the bodies that are dropping all around us or our attrition rate, which is absolutely shameful, right? Just burning through people and they're leaving. And so, but I also think that autonomy is an output to use process lingo of confidence and of mastery. And so there's a certain period of where you do have to learn the science, you do have to learn the fundamentals, you do have to learn the steps pretty intuitively so that you are able to then create the art. But it's hard to do, it's hard to pull off. It is possible. And it's like a breath of fresh air when you see it working properly. But that's what I would say about all that.
Yeah. So I wanted to let you go on that because you and I are in agreement. I look at the process. It has to be two sides of the coin. For too long, it was just the side of the coin of how the seller is, hence Bant, right? And I think we're finally getting to the point where in B2B sales, we're looking at more how B2C is doing it, where buyer's journey, that customer journey, is so vitally important. And so if you can have both sides of the coin as to align the seller's process with the buying process, because especially if you're, and I just made a post about this today, especially if you have more of a complex, difficult sale where they're not buying this thing all the time, so they maybe have never purchased it before. My viewpoint is that seller should be able to lay out the roadmap of here's the best, most efficient way that we found people can go through this. Let's work through this together to de-risk that purchase, de-risk that, you know, getting stuck in status quo and just putting up with it, which is where a lot of these sales are landing. So I look at the coin being on edge, and it really easy to flip one side or the other, but it has to have a both and of seller and buyer. So thoughts on that?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I'm reminded, well, one, I'm built. You ever do one of those murder mystery dinners? I love that you said about risk. Like, do you know what I'm talking about? These, like you get a character or whatever, you go costume. Yep. Okay. So I'm writing one for Who Murdered the Deal. And...
likely the seller.
Yeah, well, that's a great point, but it just to like help people
in the ballroom.
Help people think through the risk that's posed on the human front from the buying team and those around the buying team. But anyway, it's an interesting thing when I think about process and versus or process and enablement, because I think there's this like really like pervasive thinking that there's such a thing as a natural seller. And I don't know about you, Brian, but I've never met any natural sellers. I haven't met any natural attorneys or natural doctors either. Just putting it out there. And so when you have this mindset that like, we can just hire somebody that's good at talking to people or somebody that's sold somewhere else before and like just perpetuating this awful lookalike model that doesn't work. We don't have as much responsibility as the leadership team to actually one, understand what's going on in the nuances of our complex deal cycle, right? To the point where it's like, oh my gosh, it's just a one-off thing. It's like complete magic. And which is what a lot of people think, which is not true. But also when we're able to lean into this idea that we need to train the human and the seller at the same time and actually teach them and coach them on what are the, I like to pull from Andy's new book, The Pillars, right? Connection, curiosity, understanding, generosity, and they each build off of one another. And so, but if I'm harboring this mindset that like, there's a thing as natural sellers or that the nuance of these complex deals are just so one-off that there is nothing repeatable to be identified or derived from them, like studying them, then you stand zero chance of actually getting to a point where you've got a process that serves the buyer, serves the seller, right? Once again, when the seller wins, everybody wins, and as well as the organization, which I think just right now, it's our processes are serving the company and like hard stop.
And something that I learned from Andy, and you can go back and check his episode. It's episode 88. Okay. He talks about using those four pillars to get somebody to the point of satisficing. And I'd not heard that term before, but if you can get them to the point of satisficing, then got it. They're gonna go with you likely over everyone else because you're able to de-risk that, get them to realize that this is going to satisfy all that we need and we don't have to go down this path anymore. Because if you think about it, when they're putting in these projects or they're making these purchases, that's keeping them away from the day-to-day. And the sooner you can get them out of this pain and extra workload, the sooner they can get back to doing what they should be doing, especially if you're selling some type of sales product.
Yeah, I think every salesperson should spend time on a buying team. Like I read an interesting stat this morning. It was like the number of marketing technology tools from 2011 to 2019 actually increased by 450%. It went from like 111 to something over 7,000. But anyway, so we're making all these purchases as sales teams. And I think that having a rotation of sellers on the purchasing team so that they can experience what this feels like and the risk and whatever. But anyway, I think you're spot on, Brian. And what one thing I would add to that, and is that when Andy broke down the pillars, right, they build off of each other, right? Again, connection, curiosity, understanding, and generosity. Step one is to figure out how to connect, and good luck being able to, you know, get like apply curiosity in a meaningful way if you haven't formed that connection, right? You can ask all the questions you want, but somebody does not need to answer them. But more to the point, he breaks down the feelings of these pillars on both sides as the seller, right? How is this better than being salesy and trying to persuade somebody ad nauseum? But also take understanding as an example. What does it feel like to be understood? What does it feel, and how rare is that? And so when you're, as a seller, are able to give your buyer the signals and the feels that come with, I understand what you're saying, right? On all fronts. And I feel your pain, whatever, not in a like wishy-washy way, but like true cognitive empathy. You don't have to work very hard to differentiate yourself when that is the experience that you're giving to your buyers. And to your point, Brian, yeah, that's a game over moment.
Yeah. And the reason that most people don't buy, or the reason that most people will leave you if they've purchased something from you and they leave you, is because they don't believe that you understand them. They don't believe that they understand your business model. And so that you don't understand their business
or models. That you care, yeah, and more than care. About you hitting your number or your pipeline being full, like whatever, or your boss cares more than whatever.
Yeah. I have this, huge company. Everybody would know it. You're likely all on it multiple times in a day or week, especially if you're in sales or marketing. And I told them that I'm not renewing a certain piece. And he didn't ask, oh, what did we do wrong or why? It was like, well, why not? What are you doing? What are you thinking? Right? It's like zero empathy, didn't care. And I was just so frustrated with him. Anyway, that's
also, it assumes that you haven't done your own homework and like gone through the effort of, you know, is this working and why and how? And like, this is another soapbox of mine, ROI, right? People get this concept wrong. ROI is not an A versus B decision, friends. ROI is an A versus B, C, or D decision. And so those dollars that Brian is talking about, it's not just do I renew or do I not renew? It's where else can I spend those dollars or invest those dollars to yield a similar return? But anyway, shame on that seller.
Yeah, and there's more and more competition out there. So, you know, you're
up 450% in the past 5 years.
You're not the only game in town anymore, my friend. Well, the other thing that you talked about in that dynamic system. So what I wanted to make sure is in that dynamic system, we're not changing for change sake, but you're suggesting that, you know, almost think of it as a road. You have a lot of space on a road that you can utilize, but there are definite guide rails. So that's kind of what you're talking
about.
Bumper
bowling, yeah.
Yeah, that dynamics. And then anybody, whenever they look at an engagement, whenever you look at an employee, anybody is looking for three things. They're looking for autonomy, self-mastery, right? They master what they're doing there. Not self-mastery, but mastery of that skill set of what their job is. And then the last thing is that what they do has meaning, that at the end of the day, that what they're doing is helping somebody to achieve something. So what they do counts, it matters. And if you can get those three things in that sales process, allowing that autonomy to come in and out, knowing the checkpoints to go through in that stage gate or phase gate management, it's not linear, like you pointed out. You might have to go fast forward and then revert back. And it's not just, oh, we must do all of this and then go to that. If you're doing that, you're going to lose out big time to a skilled salesperson that's helping to better understand that buyer and truly solving the problem with them to create a you know, co-create the solution that, oh, by the way, just happens to be this one that you sell.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dan said, I love the word co-create too. I use that one often. I don't hear it very often, Brian. You just went up a couple notches on my cool chart.
Sweet. I'm finally in the cool crowd.
Can I add something to that though?
Please.
Like, okay, I'm talking to the sellers directly now, listeners. I'm a millennial, right? I'm at the front end of that curve, but a millennial nonetheless. And so our generation, we were raised differently, like all generations. And there tends to be this belief that, how do I say this politely?
You've already dropped the F-bomb.
Learning, yeah. I'm like, I'm from Jersey. I'm like one big explicit like stamp should just be on my forehead. Learning, I don't want to say paying your dues, but this is a hard business, right? And there, and you got to do a lot of it, especially while you're learning. Like, I highly encourage everybody to learn quickly, right? Do a lot of it quickly so that you like just kind of rip off the band-aid. You don't have to wallow in it. But there's mastery takes time. Competence takes time. And we, there are no damn shortcuts. And so I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind. Like, put your head down, do your job, take care of your people, take care of your buyers, take care of your teammates around you, and earn the right to operate in a more autonomous capacity, right? This assumes that we've done a good job of scoping the roles that we're in and like using tools like RepU and making decisions based on how we want to sell and does this align with where I'm looking. But then the second piece of it is that like this idea of passion or like loving what you do. I heard a great podcast this weekend and it talked about how passion is an output of mastery. And so I love, Brian, how you brought it third. But I think that one of the things that's hard about this profession is that it feels less than, or could feel less than sometimes. And I empathize with that. However, nothing could be further from the truth. But again, to the point, like put in the work, put in the hours, put in the practice and work with what you're given, the fundamentals of the steps that you're given, and then learn how to iterate on your approach from there. And again, no skipping steps, patience, and of course, you know, lean into the journey, right? Focus. The only competition that matters in this business is getting a little bit better than yesterday's version of yourself. Another hard stop.
Yeah. So, and I always say, content with who you are, discontent to stay who you are, right? It's always looking at how can I be better today than I was yesterday, knowing today I have to improve even more, yet today being satisfied with who I am. And that's the real challenge. And it's curious, right? So if things are changing so much, it's really easy, especially in this tight labor market, to shortchange yourself to only spend 4, 6, 8, 10 months as an SDR, BDR before you move into whatever next role it is. And I'm really going to encourage you. There was a person on one of the communities that I'm in said, hey, I'm 5 months into this SDR role. I'm looking to become an AE. And I said, let me share something with you that you're not going to like. Stay put for 18 to 24 months. I mean, and sure enough, they left, right? They moved into that next role. And if you moved into that next role too quickly, fast is slow and slow is fast, it's going to slow you down. And if you have to go back because you were ineffective as that AE, especially now, the market has flattened out and they're talking about this looming recession. It's easy to take orders. It's hard to sell. And it's even harder to sell in a down market, which people haven't known for the last 12 years or so. And so they better strap in, buckle up and get ready to learn, you know, Andy Paul's way of selling and how to do this effectively. Go ahead. You had something.
Yeah, no, it's funny. Andy and I were just talking about the recession. And what I love about the sell-in stuff is that it focuses on effectiveness, right? And obviously training the human, but it's like, it's amazing how much damage you could do on, you know, let's say a 5-point increase in your win rate at scale, like just for the revenue and for your bottom line. But a couple of things. There is actually an organization called SDR Defenders for a reason, and it totally depends on what organization a person is sitting in. Like that would be something that I would be very interested in sussing out before giving anybody any direction on that one. But I'll just leave that there. The second thing is that I was a full cycle AE the entire time, right? Yeah. There was never a point in my career where someone was opening up opportunities for me, which sounds pretty lovely. And you're pointing at yourself, Brian, I know you feel this too. And so I think that one of the, and don't get me wrong, I'm pretty squarely camp full cycle, but you know, obviously the nature of the sale and the team, like whatever, there are factors that are worth considering. But that said, one of the reasons that I'm camp full cycle for the most part is one, because it does create this, I don't know, it's almost like a sense of entitlement. But at the same time, if my job is to teach you how to be an enterprise seller, and I haven't taught you how to open up enterprise deals, like at that at enterprise level, then have I taught you how to be an enterprise seller? And I would say, no, I have not. And so part of the way that I'm thinking about it, like you should be hunting and prospecting and sourcing your own opportunities, even as an AE. And yeah. So that's not necessarily a skill that I think just like dies once somebody steps into the AE role, quite the opposite.
Yeah, if you're not sourcing 20 to 40% of your own or expecting to do that, then you're in trouble. And shame on you for allowing, you know, if you say marketing isn't giving me my leads or my SDR, BDR isn't doing their job. No, it's actually you who's not doing your job. So
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, and I always like think of the strain it puts on the buyers too, right? How many times have like having to have the same discovery conversation, like one time with the SDR, just because the AE didn't read the notes that, or hasn't coached their SDR. Like it's the buyers that feel the friction too. So yeah,
very much so. Well, my goodness. All right. So we didn't get a chance to go down to content or training and coaching, but I do want to hit this real quick.
Sure.
And you, because you brought it up, and then we'll rapid fire the next couple of things. Training and coaching, and you specifically said training new managers. Mm-hmm. And one of the core competencies of managers is not supervision. Especially today, because with all of the sales enablement tools that we have out there, I'm talking technology wise through RevOps, you know what's going on. You don't need to micromanage them. You know how many conversations, connect rates, and everything else. It's the ability to coach is really the new superpower for sales management and sales leadership, that sales leadership to coach the sales managers and sales managers to coach their sales teams. So that's my bias. I'm kind of curious if that aligns with what you're seeing out there.
Yeah, very much so. I would add that it's not very new, right? To have the great coaches deliver great things. And so for anybody that's interested in this topic, I would point at Google did a study. Actually, they did it twice. It's called Project Oxygen. And they were very curious about this concept of, you know, what are the character traits that makes for a great manager and a successful team? And so they dug into it. And there were 8 factors the first time, hard and soft skills together, of which the last one or one of the lowest ones was technical acumen, right? Having the ability to do the job. And again, very low on the list. Important, but this is technically one of the only things that we have historically promoted on in this profession, right? Oh, you've sold. Okay, great. So you leap manage, and like there's zero onboarding programs, like zero, to the point where it is embarrassing and shameful or funny, depending on the day.
The old adage is, oh, you just promoted your best salesperson into your sales manager. Okay. Sorry to hear that you lost them both, right? Because you lost your greatest salesperson and they're going to get fired as a sales manager because it's completely different skills.
Yeah. It's like, so I go deep into this one in that mental health article for Sales Hacker. And so Peter's principle is another thing that comes to mind. We promote people to the point where they're good at doing the job. Yeah. They just hang out. That one strikes me, but no. And I think also, It aligns actually with a lot about what we were talking about with sell without selling out, is that, and that every buyer buys differently. Every seller, like how you choose to sell is your choice. Ultimately, it's your job on the line when you don't hit your number. And so like, you may as well. Anyway, that said, coaching people, coaching your team it's not a one size fits all either, right? And so one of the, this was a conversation I had on my show recently with the great Meg Mishak. And I was like, Meg, how do you help elite sellers identify or hone in on what skills to work on next, right? At that point where you've already figured it all out. And so we laugh about it almost always being discovery, but then she's like, it really is different with every single person. And so having enough understanding there, I think letting go of your experience, right? Again, those experiences that may have worked for you 10 years ago. And also one of my favorite questions to ask sales managers when, you know, historically when I was looking at, but frankly, sales enablement positions is, when was the last time you let a seller on your team run with a plan that you didn't initially agree with at the beginning? Like, tell me the story. And so like, there's that vulnerability and courage piece to it as well. And then I think I'll even add to this. There's also a skill set around learning how to coach a team of people. Yeah. Right. And so I think that I see the way that we use dashboards, right, really aggressively. And it really hurts the relationship that sellers have with their peers often, because you start to hoard secrets or like tactics. I did a post about this or commented on Amy Volus's post today. She was like, what's one of the worst pieces of advice you've ever gotten in your career? And this was one I was given as a seller, like, don't tell anybody this cool thing that you just figured out, just like nonsense. But anyway, so those are big pieces of it. And like all things, Brian, it starts with the hard conversations that you need to have with yourself. Yeah. And I think mental health is a massive, massive part of this as well, especially in this job. And so I'd like to see a beef up on the core competencies on that front as well.
Yeah. All right. So shoot, we're quickly running out of time here. So let's rapid fire these last couple of questions, but really enjoying the conversation, Amy. I can't thank you enough. So when you look at maybe an organization that's starting to implement sales enablement, what would you say the biggest challenges or mistakes that you see people make that we should avoid?
That's a big sign. At the beginning, I would say it's a lack of the charter, right? Having a really deep understanding of this is what the role is, this is what we're set out to accomplish, and then, you know, gathering the voice of the stakeholders, right? Because sales enablement, it really is a highly collaborative function. You're working with product for product launches. You're working with marketing for collateral. You're working with rev ops around comp and, you know, tech and process and all that stuff. Obviously the sales leaders and sales managers. And so making sure that everybody's on the same page is one of the most important steps that absolutely cannot be skipped. And I think when it comes to like actually doing a training, the other thing that I would say is to do a little bit more work to dig into like what the actual problem is, right? It's very easy to just toss out as a sales leader or a sales boss to say like, you know, we're struggling with like legal. Legal's a blocker. So let's do a training on contracting. Right. This is actually a thing that happened. But when I dug into it, it was actually the process, right? Our average turnaround time for contracting start to finish was like six months. This is a process issue. And so it's very simple to get almost dragged into chasing after solving for symptoms. And definitely that does not move the needle at all. So those would be two things.
Yeah. And it's so easy to solve the wrong problem. And so whenever you're talking about defining the role, I just marked these down. Would you say that it could be as simple as defining that sales service level agreement, defining what success looks like and how we'll be measured?
Yeah. It's all the standard stuff in a project charter. So what's our objective? I like using problem statements. Yeah. What's the objective? What is the plan? What are our success metrics? What's in scope? What's out of scope? All those things. So I would definitely say Google Project Charter and just follow the template.
Got it. And then what's maybe a suggestion you would have in the talent needed to be able to do this? What should we be looking for when bringing on talent that can execute or fully leverage sales enablement tools?
I happen to believe deeply in the difference between lived and learned experience. pulling from your sales floor, right? Or people that have sold, is it's very hard to earn the respect or the trust or the attention of your sales floor without having lived that experience. And so that would be something that I would point at. And then the second, gosh, I don't know. I'm looking for people that are really, really invested in helping others succeed.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I totally agree with that. Now, how about any resources that you might recommend? Books, podcasts, guides that we should check out to be as brilliant as you on sales enablement?
So I think the first one that comes to mind, it's the great Roger Jefferson. His Sales Enablement 3.0 is a fantastic book. And then I think it's the Sales Enablement Playbook. I want to say the guy, the CEO of Closed Loop did it. The name is escaping me. And then Tamara Shank, who she used to be at CSO Insights. She took point on I think they did 5 of them, like the 5th annual sales enablement study or report. That was really good. And then tomorrow's book, Sales Enablement, also exceptional. So those are the 3 things. By way of podcasts, I think Andy's podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, is bar none. And I don't know. I talk sales enablement every now and then on my show, but I'm more like working on the core competencies and speaking to sellers there, but that a little biased, Brian, but Revenue Real Hotline is also a great place to go play.
Definitely check it out. Right now, what do you see the future holding? What has you super excited? Like, oh, I can't wait, or running away in absolute fear.
I was asked at the kitchen table every night when I was growing up, when did we feel butterflies in your stomach that day? And the analogy was used to remind us that if you did not feel uncomfortable today, you did not grow. And so I wouldn't say that there's anything that's got me running away in fear these days, but I will say I am very, very, very excited about the number of people that are executing differently and trying new things, whether this is bringing in like, Ashley Welsh, who wrote a book called Naked Sales on design thinking, and like actually just like going through the buyer's journey and like mapping it out, like, and then creating a new process, or I don't know, adding a new stage around the process. Like, I think mutual planning is one that comes to mind as a great one. Like, just want to stick that one right in there. But mostly, I think mostly it's the pivot to training sellers how to be human beings instead of training the human out of people so that they can use persuasion like a blunt force instrument of last resort that, by the way, everyone despises experiencing themselves.
No kidding. Love it. All right. So who should reach out to you, Amy? Why should they reach out to you, and how should they do it?
Anybody. I'm on LinkedIn. That's the easiest way for sure. If you could get over the hump of like figuring out how to spell my last name, maybe Brian will link it in the show notes. That's the best way. And as far as who, anybody, I mean, I work with people that are pivoting into tech sales, right? If you want to break into the industry, call me. If you want to level up your game, and like, I produce content on there every day. And so I would say, definitely say, follow me over there. And then of course, any sales leaders that are looking to introduce a cutting new medium to enable and empower their reps by way of sales podcasts, internal sales podcasts, like, you could definitely hit me up.
Nice. Well, I love it. All right. So let's sum this up here. Make sure that you're selling as a human. Let's think in ink. I'm going to take that one. I love that line. Let's think in ink. Let's make sure as sales leaders that we're allowing our team to have autonomy, mastery, and purpose in what they're doing and around this dynamic system of that process. And then let's try out and reach out to Amy to try some internal podcasts. Sounds pretty cool. Hey, thanks, Amy, so much. I really appreciate it. Check her out. HREHOVCIK. So you can check her out, Amy, on LinkedIn there, and check that out. Put that in the show notes. Share this, like it, shoot it out there on your Apple Podcasts and your Spotify. And we thank you as always. Put application to this. Learning for learning's sake is pointless. Learning for application's sake. Come on, help the community thrive through entrepreneurship. See ya.